This is the Jungle Jim Hunter Show, only on the Fan 960, Calgary's only all sports radio.
If you own something you cannot give away, then you don't own it. It owns you. Albert Schweitzer said that. Transitioning points in our life are always just around the corner from major achievement. Most of us won't go forward with reaching for our dreams because we think it's the achievement that is so hard to reach. But in almost every case, that's not telling ourselves the truth. It's the what happens next that keeps us from going for the gold. What is controlling your life? Wanting to reach for the goal, or what will happen after you reach the goal? Points of conquest are always the points of change because they require us to go in a different direction. You see, birth is traumatic. Learning to walk is dynamic. First day of school, the first solo, the first win, a career change. It's the unknown. What happens now that causes anxiety? It's the uncertainty. What will I do now? It's the unbelievable effect. Will I be able to do it again? And finally, it's the uncomfortable. Yeah. Who will I become? That unsettles us. We will fill up the empty spaces in our hearts and day and attitudes with emotional link points of transition. Now, I want you to think about these. You and I didn't ask to be born. We didn't choose our mother and father. We didn't choose our race. We didn't choose the color of our skin. We didn't have a choice in the language that we learned as a child. We didn't have a choice to a large part, in many ways, to the community we were born and raised in. We didn't even choose the schools we attended. And for most of us, we don't start making decisions for ourselves until after it's been chosen for us. Where we're going to go to university or where that first job is. And in most cases, these choices are made for us, or the circumstances around us are forced to make the choice for us. Parents who use manipulation and behavior and performance as the measuring stick instead of progress are paralyzing their kids. Transition is difficult, and like the 19-year-old waiter last night at the restaurant, when I asked her, "What do you want to do with your life?" She replied, "I don't know. I don't know. I don't know." I was thinking by 19 I'd been to the Olympics, won a bronze medal. I'd seen half the world. And then I thought, the greatest gift my parents gave me was personal responsibility starting at 6 years of age. You choose the clothes you wear. You choose the choices that you make. You make the mistakes and learn from them. But when you make great choices, you celebrate the life you built at each transition. I read a poem that said he wished for a wonderful place called the Land of Beginning Again, where all our cares, heartaches, and grief could be dropped like a shabby old coat at the door and never put on again. There is such a place. Now. Recently, I heard of a 40th birthday where the birthday girl invited all her friends to come to her party and take one thing rather than give her something because she realized she had more than she needed and it was time to lighten her load. Maybe it's time for you to lighten yours. If you are so busy collecting clutter that will only collect dust and be forgotten, then you'll have little time and space to build what really counts, character. Do what others won't. If your performance is packed with a possession and position of perfection, your performance will be paralyzed, packing too many possessions. You listen to the Jungle Jim Hunter Show on Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 960, fan960.com. I'm here with Christina Smith, my beautiful cohort, as always.
Thank you.
Always bright and happy and ready to go and ready to do things. And our first guest this morning, Christina, is Jonathan Reimer from the PT Advantage Health Hint. He's going to do it for us. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
He's in athletic therapy as a degree. Man, this guy's got a list. I'm not even going to list these. There's so many of them, Jonathan. Wow.
Yeah, a lot of years of training.
Wow. People talk about core strength. Let's get a clear picture of what it means to strengthen our core from every vantage.
Well, yeah, most people that talk about core strength in your popular exercise programs nowadays are talking about general abdominal and low back strengthening. The thing is that these muscles are designed to move us and not to specifically stabilize us. So if we try to recruit them to create stability in our spine, what ends up happening is we get harmful compressive and shear forces. as opposed to being able to use them for their proper function, which is to move us for athletic participation and other activities.
Now, anyone that does a sit-up, you know, they're thinking that they're doing this core strength. However, can you tell them how wrong it is that it's not just the sit-up that makes you feel that way or that it attains what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the research defines the true core. It's our deepest layer of abdominal and low back muscles. They include the transverse abdominis, the multifidus, the pelvic floor, and the diaphragm. So most regular type of sit-up exercises, they don't specifically target these muscles. And if you're not functioning properly or if those muscles aren't firing properly, those typical types of programs can actually have harmful effects instead of beneficial.
How can you know if you have someone that is teaching you the right way to do core training? Because I've seen what you've just talked about. I've seen people that, you know, they look in a book, they take out a list of exercises, and they say, do this, do this, do this. And I look at it, and I go, man, from a core strength for training program, if I just listen and you're training for this sport or that sport, you're doing the wrong exercises. You're not even doing the right ones. And you're going to go through this whole workout, and you're not going in the right direction. How can you know, or what are some of the clues that you can use to identify people that know what they're doing when it comes to core training?
Yeah, that's a great question. Honestly, it takes years of experience, in my opinion, to properly be able to palpate or feel those muscles in action and determine whether or not they're firing. And then the other thing that we do as therapists, and probably some well-trained personal trainers have these abilities as well, you look for compensatory movements that suggest that the core is not working, that you're relying on your outer abdominal muscles. And I don't want to imply that abdominal strength or back strength is a bad thing. It's just that those muscles have a specific purpose, and if we're not using the inner core to create a brace for us, then we're going to actually end up not maximizing our functional capabilities.
So essentially, if you're overweight, you have very little core strength. So that push, like, would that put any type of stress on the lower back then?
Yeah, I mean, definitely being overweight can put a lot of load on our back that can create problems. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have good core function. I've seen elite-level athletes with really poor core function. And basically what you're losing is that internal bracing system that creates stability or powerful movements. So I would say it's typically those individuals that have had a back injury or people that have complained about having a bad back for years. Those are the ones that should definitely get checked out, because pain can inhibit the function of the core, and you can work really hard to try to get it firing, but unless you know the proper steps to take and the proper exercises to do, you're likely going to just end up doing a general abdominal strengthening program, which can actually, as I said, have more problematic effects for you.
Absolutely. Hey, Jonathan, thanks so much. How do people get a hold of you if they want to find you?
Well, we're over at Advantage Health Aspen in the Southwest. Okay. But we do have a number of other Advantage Health clinics in the city. Our number is 403-242-9001. Sorry, I had a little brain
lapse. It's morning. That's morning. That's all right.
And PT Health offers free consultation and a $20 off any of the services for new clients. So, but they have to say that
they heard it on here.
On the Jungle Jim Hunter Show.
Thanks, Jonathan.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Christina.
Yes.
Another week.
That's right.
Another week has gone by.
Oh, I hear it.
Do you hear the music?
I hear it. We are.
It's coming. It's
excitement.
Coming. He is going to do it. He's there.
He is.
I am so pumped to talk to him today. I can't wait.
Woo! Mr. Rocky himself, the Iceman.
The Iceman.
In Nepal.
Bill, how are you? Bill Borger is on the face of Everest. We're talking to him around the world. Welcome back to the program.
Hello. Thank you.
Where do we find you on the face of Everest this morning?
Actually, catch me back at base camp. The past week we spent climbing Wabashay, which was a lot of fun because we beat all the big teams up there, so there's no fixed line, so it was a real mountaineering experience, which you don't get a lot in the Himalayas here, and took a cruise towards Camp 1, and that's so far where we're at, feeling good.
Describe the scope of the mountain and what you're feeling, because last week we asked you to describe what you're seeing, and you just said it was massive. And now what are you feeling this week, the second week?
I feel good. It's kind of surreal here, especially at nighttime when you have a full moon. It's like the mountains are all white, like it's daytime.
Uh-huh.
With a black sky and lots of stars. It's kind of surreal, like being in a cartoon. The scope of the mountain isn't as intimidating as it was last week, because we got a chance to go through the Kimball Icefall and towards Camp 1. And we actually had a lot of fun up there. You always see the footage of people walking over on the ladders very tentatively. We had some fun, and John would rappel back down into the crevasse, and I would swing underneath like they're monkey bars. And then I'd mantle it at the end.
Nice.
We're taking this very seriously.
You're not taking this very serious, are you?
We're having some fun. We have some great footage, but I don't have the cord to get it off my camera. But it's really kind of funny when you see someone swinging underneath of the icefall ladders.
Now, how has your perspective changed since last week, and what kind of challenges are you facing right now?
It's perspective hasn't changed very much from last week. I'm still very confident. The challenges that we're facing is we keep going higher and higher, and you really start to feel that, and it starts to give you some wicked headaches. But other than that, I'm being looked after extremely well by the Sherpa team here and great cooks, and it's actually a lot of fun.
Is anything changing in your mental perspective or your physical shape? Have you seen anything yet change?
Mentally this is probably a low week as far as missing my kids. And I still have another 6 weeks to go probably.
Yeah.
But physically I've probably lost at least 20 pounds. I can't keep the weight on up here even though I'm eating very well. It's just the altitude, it sheds away.
Wow.
So your muscles are hypertrophying then. Now I see also the big total so far, $373,300 have been raised for Calgary Handy Bus. We could follow you also on Board Your Peak and Pond on the website for all their great, great pictures. How's that feeling with that new total?
I'm stoked, actually. Yeah, very, very happy.
That's awesome.
If everything goes right, where will you be next week, Bill?
By the time I talk to you next week, I'll probably be at base camp again. We're going to go up to Camp 2 and spend a few days there. Well, tomorrow we have the puja ceremony where they bless our gear and they bless our Sherpas and ourselves. And then we'll hit the main mountain, and we're going to hit Camp 2 for a few nights and then come back down to base camp. So next week I'll probably be at base camp again.
Beautiful. Hey, thanks, Bill. We really appreciate you doing this every week, and we're looking forward to you talking with you every week as you make your progress up the face of Mount Everest.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We're cheering for you back
cheering
here.
Cheering for you, Rocky.
We're
Superman.
We're so pumped. We can't believe it.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Bill. That's Bill Borger. He's on the face of Everest.
Can you
like,
believe
where
that?
Else in the world? I don't know. Maybe I'm just guessing here, Christina. But where else in the world can you talk to Olympic athletes on a Saturday morning and hear what they have to say, and talk to a guy climbing Mount Everest
who's already swam the English Channel?
Yeah, and
biked across Canada. I mean, and he's like invincible.
This is the kind of people we like.
That's right.
This is what Canadians do.
That's right.
Making transitions, making changes.
And you can follow him on the Jungle Jim Hunter Show.
Yeah. And you can follow us on Jungle Jim Hunter if you want to follow our Twitters or tweets or twits or whatever we are. I don't know what we are. If you want to hear my headshots, I'm sending them almost every day. Sometimes I send 5 at a time. What if I'm watching Don Cherry on TV? He drives me crazy. Oh, the guy he's insane.
And what's your tweet?
Jungle Jim Hunter.
There you go.
And yours?
Push, start, go.
There you go. Today's lineup is going to be unbelievable, but before we get to that lineup, we are going to just talk a little bit about transitioning. That's the focus of today. We wanted to talk about transitioning. Part of the reason why is because right now the city of Calgary is going through one. The transition is this. The Calgary Flames are not in the playoffs, and we're transitioning from another season to another season without being in the playoffs. And so it affects you. You say, no, it doesn't matter. Yeah, it does. Because it's a transition point. It's a change point. It's a link point. It has emotional links to it. What about you, Christina? What emotional link points have you had that that when you look back, you say, these changed me?
Well, for sure, you know, transition out of sport, that was massive.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I transitioned out of the house.
Oh, you did it this week. Yeah, that's right.
No, but I also did it when I retired.
Uh-huh.
And so everything was, I mean, you don't realize how spoilt you are
uh-huh.
until it's gone.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I was and still am, you know, I'd say spoiled from my mom and dad. But I think it's more so just the loss of not only, you know, this past life, but also the loss of having things done for you and support. And I mean, as an athlete, you have, you know, services like a cell phone, and you have coaches that set up your schedules. And I mean, people that end up, in a sense, having some sense of control or some sense of organization for you. And now it's up to you to perform all that. So sounds kind of funny, but I was spoiled.
Wow. When we come back, we're going to talk to Ryan Blaze, who's making the transition. He's announced his retirement. He's a Canadian freestyle aerialist. We're going to talk to him about what he's going through and what he's going to do now that he's retired from the national aerial team. You're listening to the Jungle Jim Hunter Show on Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 960 and fan960.com. We'll be right back.
This is the Jungle Jim Hunter Show, only on the Fan 960, Calgary's only all sports radio.
Had an agenda. It was a very smooth transition. You see, when we change, when we go through a change in life, when we are faced with the fact that it's inevitable, we have to transition. And the hard part for most of us is we're not ready for that. We don't plan for it. I always think it's funny at the end of the World Series or Super Bowl or the Stanley Cup, they always ask somebody, where are you going? And they hold the trophy over their head and they yell, I'm going to Disneyland. As if somehow that was a goal. That was a good transition. Well, it's a good opportunity to take advantage of somebody in a high-profile situation, but I'm not necessarily thinking it's a great way to transition. Right? Ryan Blaze competed for 10 years on the national team as a freestyle aerialist with 19 top 10 finishes, including 8 podiums and 2 wins. He's a native of Grand Prairie. He was a part of the elite Canadian Air Force. And he said this, I feel lucky to have been immersed in a team where I found my best friends to become my best competitive rivals. You know what? That shows a sign of a mature person who is inspired by competition, not discouraged. That's cool. Mm-hmm. That's cool. Ryan, welcome back to the program.
How are you doing? Thanks for having me on again.
It's great to have you. You fell in love with this sport after going to a water ramp camp, and what inspired you to take up this sport? Because I thought this was kind of interesting when we were looking at your bio, how you went to this water ramp camp and all of a sudden said, I want to do this.
Yeah, you know, we kind of went on a whim. I had one of my best friends in Grand Prairie read a brochure about this camp in Red Deer where you could go and learn how to do flippity-floppities into the water, and, you know, we went on a whim. Took a road trip down, and once we arrived there, it was strange. I felt like I was at a water park, but this water park that was this best kept secret because there wasn't that many kids there, and I couldn't understand. I was like, the next day, or are there going to be 50 kids here, and there'll be a big lineup? You know, why isn't this the most popular place in the world? And I immediately fell in love with it, and I also remember thinking that as soon as we arrived, you see the jumps, the 1, 2, 3, you know, the small jumps for single flips, and then the double jump for double flips, and the triple jump for doing the, you know, the 3 big ones, which mm-hmm. the Olympic guys do. And for some reason, I thought at the end of the weekend, we'd all be doing the triples. I just was so gung-ho from the beginning, I had no idea what I was getting into.
Wow. Ryan, you've had many ups and downs, injuries. Now, what keeps you going? What are the valuable lessons that you've learned through these transitions?
Probably that is the passion part of it, because like you said, I had a lot of ups and downs, you know, a lot of hurdles. A lot of them were physical injuries. A lot of them were, you know, qualification snafus or funding. And I always just knew at the end of the day, this is something that I really, really wanted to do. I couldn't, at the end of the day, whether it was a good day or a bad day, I never had a sort of an inkling that, oh, maybe this sport isn't for me. I never felt that. So I was really just, I think I felt fortunate that I found that sort of calling for me. And so there was never any question. I think that was sort of the important part. Otherwise, I would have probably got to some of the adversity and maybe taken an easier path.
Mm-hmm. In those moments, what are some of the things you did? I mean, our listeners are parents with kids and kids in sport and coaches who coach sport. And I think sometimes we say, well, we got through the ups and downs by just going through them. And I'm curious to know, if you can remember, what are some of the things that you used as techniques to when you were sitting on the end of the bed after an injury and you're taking the cast off for the first time or whatever it is, and you're saying, okay, I want to do this again. Where does that motivation come inside of you?
Yeah, well, for a couple of the different adversities, it was a different process, but I'll talk about an example of one where I had blown out my knee. And so, you know, pretty devastating injury for an area that's, you blow out your knee, and you're just not sure that you'll be able to come back. And so, and then the process is quite long and arduous, so I reached out to other athletes that had gone through it, and, you know, they had got some key learnings along the way, and I was able to talk with them and share their frustrations and, you know, get tips. And the important part of that is, a lot of times what happens when you get injured and you get thrown to the sideline, you know, the world of the sport goes on without you, and you're just sort of left in the shadows. No one's looking after you. That wasn't the case with my team. The coaches made a conscious decision to try to keep us in the sport, even though we were clearly injured on the sidelines. So they'd reach out to you. I'd get emails from Veronica Brenner, a teammate of mine, little tips. Try to stay competitive. I don't care if you're playing cards at home with your mom. Mm-hmm. Try to win. You know, and my mom didn't like that. You know, because it was like, that was just a card game. But trying to keep that competitive fire, right?
Yeah.
So it's just little tricks like that. And then, you know, on the days when you felt like you weren't going to be able to make it, or maybe your knee was doing fine physically, but emotionally you just weren't feeling motivated.
Mm-hmm.
You give someone a call on the team, someone who had been through it. And you mentioned it earlier, sort of in the opening, that my teammates were my best friends, and that was a big part of it, because I could call them and I could tell them sort of the secrets that I guess I wouldn't tell anyone else. I could mm-hmm. just open up to them and, you know, get through them that way.
Yeah, and I think what you just said is so valuable for kids to hear, is that, you know, sometimes kids are taught to just keep quiet, don't say anything, don't mm-hmm. do anything. And, you know, I think of a young fellow that I know who's gone through a horrible experience and a very difficult experience. And, you know, his teammates around him need to do things like that. They need to call him once in a while and just say, how are you doing? And do you need anything? Or do you just want to talk and I'll just listen? I'll just shut up and listen. Or, you know, write him a note. Send him a card. And you don't realize how valuable that will be, because that's what being a teammate is. And it's sometimes we get so self-centered in trying to achieve our own goals that we think that that's the only goal that counts, and we don't realize that we are strengthened by helping somebody else be strengthened. And I love what you just said. That is so valuable. Ryan, I don't know if I say your right name right. Is it Blay or Blaze?
It's the first one.
Blay. Okay.
Yes.
I just want to make sure. I hate massacring somebody's name. What were you going to say?
No, you're doing just fine. Well, I was going to say there was an interesting point there that, so athletes, I think naturally athletes tend to be a little bit selfish and internally focused, you know, on the center of the world. And you kind of need to do that, because you, as athletes, we're like, we step onto the field and we think that we can win and we expect to win, and just crazy circumstances, and we put ourselves out there, and there's a certain sort of personality that you need to be able to do that. And a lot of it is sort of internalizing everything and putting the focus on yourself. And anyway, it's really selfish. But the thing I wanted to say is that during the rehab and all of that, oftentimes when I'd reach out to the friends, so, you know, they would give sort of emotional support. But on the flip side of it is sometimes when I'd get too sort of too internalized, or I'd be putting too much focus on myself, or too selfish, or maybe not disciplined enough, you know, they would step up and they would sort of give some constructive criticism, and because of their friends, you know, they wouldn't be shy about it. So you had a good sounding board for support when you needed it, and kind of for discipline as well when you needed it.
Mm-hmm. For sure, you definitely need to have that circle of trust with those teammates and whoever you bring into that circle, because you are at a very vulnerable moment. Now, when you look at, you know, the side of the aerialist, the prototype of what kind of athlete we're looking for. Could you tell us what that prototype is?
Yeah, you know, when I think of that, I don't think there's an athletic, like a physical form that is prototypical. In gymnastics, there would be, and I don't think there's been one that we've nailed yet. We're still too young of a sport. But it would probably be someone who deals well with adversity, someone who's flexible, you know, emotionally flexible, flexible in process, you know, how they need to work. Because what happens is we're one of those sports where, as an example, trampoline. The trampoline's basically the exact same every day. You're inside. There's no wind, this and that. Aerials, we travel around the world, and every day the conditions are completely different. The jump is a different shape. The wind's there. Maybe the wind's not there. Maybe it's raining. So you have to be able to adapt, and you have to be a little bit plastic. You know, there's this plasticity that you need as an athlete. And then you need to be, I guess, mentally strong enough to deal with that and to sort of pick your battles. So one of the things that I've always told young athletes is, generally, if it's out of your control, i.e. the weather, let it go. You know, mm-hmm. That's not to say you're ignoring it, but I used to get really bent out of shape about things that I couldn't control, an athlete that was doing better than me, an athlete that just broke their leg in front of me, or bad weather, but I couldn't control it. Of course I couldn't control it, so I learned to just sort of push it off to the side and not let it bog me down. So it's that ability to have that flexibility to deal with all that crap, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to the Jungle Jim Hunter Show, and you're listening to Jungle Jim Hunter and Christina Smith talk to Ryan Blay. He's a Canadian aerialist, one of our greatest aerialists. He's been a fabulous performer. You're listening to us on Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 960, and fan960.com. If you want to follow us, you can follow us on Jungle Jim Hunter. That's my twit and tweet, Twitter, whatever it is. I don't know. What are you supposed to say, Ryan? I know you're into social media.
My Twitter account.
Oh, there we go. My Twitter account. Anyway, Ryan, when you hear the words Steve Omichel, Jeff Bean, Kyle Nissen, Warren Schuldeis, what words come to mind to describe that team? Because we were known as the Crazy Canucks. You guys were known as what?
Oh, the Canadian Air Force. So that's interesting. The you know, the Crazy Canucks, the parallel would be the Quebec Air Force, you know, through the early 70s into the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I came onto the team, we had this sort of this transition of the new Air Force, and we actually tended to be based more from the West. Steve was from out in Ontario. You know, but when I hear those names, actually, I don't even think of it immediately in the context of sport. I just think of my best friends. This summer, for example, we're all getting together to go to Warren's cabin.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing to do with sports at all. So, like, they literally are my best friends. But if I hear those names in the context of sport, I think of, I guess it would be best practices. You know, we worked together as a team, and we were all very unique. We all had completely different styles of training and competition, but we tended to gravitate towards and find, and I guess work towards finding what the best practices were for us. So, you know, for Warren, it was less is more. You know, he would be really critical on every decision he made, and he would completely evaluate sort of the pros and cons of taking a jump. And if he didn't find supreme value in it, he would pack it in for the day. Whereas myself, I was a numbers guy. I just needed to pound it. I needed to pound through. It was good for my confidence. You know, Steve was very aggressively competitive. And what we found is sort of we dialed it into what worked best for ourselves, and then, you know, how to... Those were very conflicting styles within the team. I can tell you that early on, Steve and I did not, you know, we were not very friendly to each other. But we had different styles, and we couldn't decide to, you know, to back off our own style because it was good for our own competition. So we had to find a way to marry it as a team.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had this sort of this template for a team that had these best practices, you know, driven down from the coach. But then individually, we each had our own methods that we tailored for our own athletic abilities, I guess.
Yeah.
Mm. Now, Ryan, congratulations from Jungle and I for a great career, but we've just heard that you've announced your retirement. Now, why now?
Yeah, so I announced my retirement about 4 days ago. A lot of reasons, I guess. You know, I mentioned earlier that my whole career I was very passionate. You know, there wasn't a morning I woke up where I wasn't, you know, 100% sure that I wanted to go through it. And that's not an exaggeration. I really always felt that passionate about it. I don't think I would have been able to maintain that for another Olympic cycle. you know, to 2014, I started to feel that that was dwindling, partly because of the lifestyle, living on the road, living in a suitcase, mm-hmm. putting relationships on hold, financial stability. Athletes don't make a ton of money. You putting education on hold, it was pretty difficult for winter athletes to get a good education. And I found that I started becoming really passionate about other things, and in particular, social media. So I've decided to pull away from the sport and transition into the next career, which is going to be into social media consulting. But I guess the other part of it is my body is getting beat up. Aerials is not a nice sport on the body.
No kidding.
You do that for I guess my whole career, even before the national team, that's 15 years of you know, jumping out of buildings, basically.
Yeah.
without a parachute, and it takes a toll on the body.
I every time I see Cirque du Soleil, I think of you guys. I mean, it's funny how I put the two together. I always go, these guys would be great at Cirque du Soleil if we could figure out a way to engage them in that, because, you know, you do jump, what, 65 feet in the air, 70 feet in the air?
Yeah, it wouldn't be 75. It's probably anywhere between 45 and 55.
Okay, I wasn't sure, but
yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. We want to give you the last word as we go here to the commercial break, and we've asked every athlete this: what's their most inspiring sports story or story that kept you going? What's the most inspiring story that motivated you through your career?
Mine was from Yves LaRoche. He's considered the godfather of the sport of aerials, and he retired actually before the sport went into the Olympics, so he was never an Olympian. And he later on in his career, he had a devastating hang gliding accident and almost died, and then in a coma for a hospital for a long time, and then he managed to get out, and he stayed very involved in the sport, and he has a difficult time walking and slurred speech, and generally dealt with a lot of adversity. And so I got to know him. He became a really good friend. And I mean, this guy was dealt a very, very difficult hand in life, you know, after his injury. And the positive, you know, the passion in this guy, he just loves the sport. He's not jaded by any of it. You know, I've never seen him not in a good mood. And if there's someone who needs to, you know, has a right to complain, it's him, and he doesn't. And so I use that a lot of times in my career when I was dealing with, you know, emotional struggles or fear or, you know, physical injuries. I just try to use him as an example to give me some perspective on, okay, you don't have it that bad. You know, you're doing well. Stay positive. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes I'd go and talk with him. So, yeah, certainly Yves LaRoche, he's given me a lot of inspiration.
Is he still alive, Ryan?
Yes, he is. He's in Quebec City where the team trains in Lac-Beauport.
Okay.
And it's funny, the ramp is named after him. He's still alive. And
wonderful.
And he shows up every day and just to watch us. And he sits on the sidelines sometimes and he tells me, you know, through his slurred speech, he's like, Ryan, I was up there with you. And I was like, what do you mean, Yves? He's like, I was up there flipping in with you in the air. Because he can't, obviously, do it anymore. And he just lives vicariously through us. And so you see that sparkle in his eye. And then he's just a great sounding board. And,
wow.
Again, he gives great perspective to an athlete.
And, you know, the theme this week, Ryan, is transitioning. You know, how to make transitions, how to deal with transitions. You're going through one. You need your teammates just like you did as an athlete to help you through that. You might not think so, but people like Christina and I, we've done it. We know what it's like. We know what you're going to go through. And just like Yves helped you, you're going to help many other people. You're going to have a great impact on people because you've got wisdom and knowledge and experience now that is valuable. And I applaud you for your career, but I applaud you for being such a valuable asset to kids and future kids and athletes. And press on. You've been a great example of what a Canadian athlete is all about.
Well, thank you for the compliment, Jim. That's very nice. Thank you.
Thanks so much. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to the Jungle Jim Hunter Show on Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 960 and fan960.com.
This is the Jungle Jim Hunter Show, only on the Fan 960, Calgary's only all sports radio.
Jeanette Watkins said this: work less, play more, enjoy life. As you do these three things, your life will change dramatically. This week we're talking about transitions, going through the process of changing and having to transition from one career to the next, right? Somebody around you, even you, are maybe going through it right now. Christina, we got all kinds of people we know that are going through. You're going through transition. You moved into your own apartment.
That's right.
Yeah.
For the second time. However, my dad, he's, you know, no longer working. And now he's at home making an omelet with Genevieve and Logan.
Oh, man.
Yeah, his little
grandkids. He's learning how to be a chef.
That's right.
Well, we have made a promise to ourselves. One way or the other, and we're starting now, even though it's early, Christina, but we started now because we wanted to get every sport and every Paralympic sport on before the London Olympics, and that's our goal. And just so you know, folks, there's 52 of them, plus there's, I think, 20 Paralympic sports. So we started now because if we don't do one every week, we won't get them all on, and this week we're doing volleyball. Now, you'd say, volleyball? Boy, that's a fun sport. Do we even have an Olympic volleyball team? Well, we do. But we're going to learn all about them. We're going to have our next guest is Julian Boucher, who has formerly been a CIS coach, national team assistant coach, head coach for the professional clubs overseas, and he has previously been the technical director of Ontario Volleyball Association, Quebec Volleyball Federation, and Volleyball Canada before he was named to the High Performance Director in 2009. And that's what he is, High Performance Director. Julian, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell us what you do and where you do it and where our two national training centers are.
Okay. Well, first of all, my main job is to develop and implement all our national team programs, and that includes obviously our senior teams, our Olympic teams, also all our developmental teams. Right now, we're mostly focused on our FICHU team, which is basically our senior B teams, also our junior teams. And those are summer programs only because we select to those teams players that are currently student athletes within the CIS. Mm-hmm. And I also make sure that all our provincial partners are developing their own athletes between 13 and 18 to the same standards that we'd like to see in young athletes within our national team programs.
Wow.
And we currently have a national team center for each of our teams. Our women's center is located in Winnipeg at the University of Manitoba. And our men's center recently moved a year and a half ago to Gatineau, Quebec. And they're training out of the new, brand new sports center in Gatineau.
Hmm. Now, Julien, what are the necessary physical qualities that a female would have to be on a national or Olympic team?
Well, you know, as you probably know, volleyball is a tall person's sport, eh? So obviously size helps and is actually a prerequisite. Now, how tall you have to be will always depend on how good you can combine your size with a couple of main physical abilities such as speed and power. And I would say that you know, our women's athletes are doing pretty good. Obviously, there's some powerhouses in the world like the Russians or, you know, the Eastern European countries are a bit taller than we are. But we, in terms of athleticism, we're doing all right.
What about the men's side?
Well, I would say it's pretty much the same thing. You know, at the international level, the game is not that much different, and you know, the tallest, strongest, faster teams always seem to find a way to come out on top. So as long as you can combine those main three qualities the right way, then you'll be all right.
I mean, Julian, obviously height is a big advantage, and it is the most important advantage in basketball and volleyball because of the fact that you can get up there and do things with the ball and make it happen. But I'm curious to know, are volleyball athletes slow-twitch athletes or fast-twitch athletes? I would think that most of them would have to be almost predominantly fast-twitch muscles, wouldn't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, volleyball is an explosive sport where you got to move quickly, you got to change directions quickly, and, you know, to get up in the air to attack or to block, obviously you need to do that in a split second. So fast-twitch are definitely of the essence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what qualities are key for the mental side of a female volleyball player?
Well, I think here again, there's not that much difference between the men's and the women's game. You know, the main two things we're looking for in our programs are the passion and the desire to improve and the desire to represent your country at the international level. So I think once you start with that, again, you know, it's easy to teach certain mental skills to athletes. It's a lot harder to teach passion and desire.
Mm-hmm. What's an example that you would say that when you see this, you see the passion in play? Give me an example, because I know a lot of kids who love to play volleyball. I know my kids all love playing it, and I know I love playing it. I thought it was a great sport. And I'd go on the court, and there'd be guys that wouldn't even move. And me, I was diving all over the place. I mean, yeah. I looked like I was doing swan dives every time because I wanted to get the ball. And I'm just wondering if there's a way how that passion is exhibited and what you see in athletes.
Well, obviously, at our level and in my position with the, you know, dealing closely with the national teams, once someone reaches that level, you can pretty much bank that they have a certain amount of passion and a certain amount of desire. At a younger age, it's a little bit tougher to see. I guess, you know, it's still possible, but you need to make sure that young athletes are trained properly, and you know, if coaches do their jobs right and are really concerned with someone's long-term development and point them in the right direction, I think that helps tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Julien, I was the athletic therapist at the University of Calgary, and I actually looked after the women's volleyball team and also later on the women's field hockey team.
All right.
Now, I noticed there was a huge difference in character in like team atmosphere, and I don't know whether it had something to do with that the team was separated by the net and they never had that interaction, or whether it had to do with, you know, like the interaction, like for example, you know, the volleyball or the field hockey players had on the field. What do you think about that?
Well, I think volleyball is a very unique sport in its nature. It's a very social sport in the fact that, you know, it's really tough to stand out as an individual athlete in volleyball because of the nature of the sport, where you need to have three contacts and you have to have someone, you know, set you the ball or pass the ball to the setter. I mean, it's really tough to shine individually, unlike other team sports like hockey or basketball, for instance. So I think that in itself creates a certain traits in volleyball athletes, and the fact that, you know, there's no contacts. It's kind of a unique game in a way, and I think it's, you know, if I was to compare it to something, maybe badminton is you know, all the sports that are where teams opposing each other are on the opposite sides of a net, I think is a nice comparison. So I think in itself creates the uniqueness of our sport.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking to Julien Boucher, who's the High Performance Director for Volleyball Canada. Julien, I was interested to know, who are the best teams in the world, and who do you have to play on the men's and women's side? But who are the best teams in the world right now?
Okay, well, right now, the International Federation publishes a rankings of the teams regularly, and right now, the men, for men's, the top five are in order: Brazil, Russia, Serbia, Cuba, and USA. And for women, Brazil, USA, Japan, Italy, and Russia. So those are the top teams in the world right now. We don't get to play those teams a lot unless it's in major competitions like World Championships or Pan-American Games or Olympics. So I guess within our zone, we're in a zone. The world is divided in five zones, and our zones is North America and Central America. I think the top teams in that zone are Cuba, USA, Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, and ourselves. Our women's team is currently fifth, behind USA, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, and our men are fourth, behind Cuba, USA, and Puerto Rico. So those are the teams that we play a little bit more because they're in our zone. So it's it just happens that we play those teams a little bit more, and we're, you know, in order for us to move up the rankings in the world, the best key indicator for us is if we can move up within our own zone.
Now, besides not minding getting sand in your underwear, is there really a big difference between indoor and beach volleyball in the makeup of a player?
Well, it's actually not that much, especially when the athletes are younger, because most in Canada, I would say 99% of the players, if not 100% of the beach players, were indoor players first. Once they develop a little bit more and they enter the elite stream, I think the main difference, again, is in the nature of the game. The beach game doesn't allow coaching as opposed to the indoor game. I mean, it allows coaching in competition.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the main difference is coaches that work with beach athletes have to make sure they're developed with a little bit more independence so they can make their own decisions on the court. So, but that's at the elite level. So I think that's between the two sports, those are probably the biggest difference, because the game itself, you know, you need to move, you need to move around fast, you need to jump, you need to hit, block, and read cues, and so the game is pretty similar on the beach and indoor.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know, as we come to wrap this up and come to the end of the cycle, what is your most inspiring sports story? What motivated you? What got you excited and made you to want to commit yourself to this sport and become a high-performance director?
Well, I think in my position right now, the most inspiring story is the fact that as an assistant coach with men's team in the late 80s and early 90s, I participated in the 1992 Barcelona Olympics. And obviously, we didn't do as well as we thought we should have or that we could have. And I think what motivates me is trying to make sure that our structure and our funding is adequate for both our men's and women's programs to reach that ultimate goal in the near future, is to make it back into the Olympics. And I think right now that's what keeps me going. And we're improving slowly. I was actually part of the last men's indoor team to qualify for the Olympics in 92.
Mm-hmm.
Our women's team qualified in 96 in Atlanta, and since then we haven't had an indoor team qualify for the Olympics, and that's actually what I would say keeps me going right now, plus the interaction with all of our coaches and, you know, to a lesser extent right now the athletes, but mm-hmm. that's always been my passion, and that's why I enjoy my job so much.
Thank you so much, Julian. We appreciate you taking the time out on a Saturday morning to be here, and all the best with the team in Quebec.
That's my pleasure, and thanks a lot.
Anytime. Julian Boucher, High Performance Director, another great Canadian, making a difference in kids' lives. Right?
Excellent.
I love our country. We should play the national anthem every day.
Every day.
We should play it every show. Sometime. I don't know.
Brad.
We'll do it later. Brad will get it. Anyway. You listen to Christina Smith and Jungle Jim Hunter on the Jungle Jim Hunter Show on Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 960 and fan960.com. We'll be right back.
This is the Jungle Jim Hunter Show, only on the Fan 960, Calgary's only all sports radio.
Sonia Tejada said this: nothing in life can be permanent except what you choose not to change. I want you to think about something for a second. Take water. Three states. Solid, a liquid, a gas. Which one do you want to be? Think about it. Which one? Because if you're solid, you're not going anywhere. But if you're a liquid, you flow. But if you're a gas, you can go anywhere. That's the kind of thing I want you to think about. When you go through transition, are you using the opportunity to change yourself, to be more creative, to do more things, to be able to do better things? This week on the show, we're talking about transitioning, dealing with transition. Christina, you said you had some things you had to do, deal with transitioning. What did you have to do with? Give me an example of something you went through.
Well, of course, it all comes down to that leaving your career, big thing in sport. And I think, if anything, it was like a death. It was like being divorced. It, you know, the stress of loss or change of your identity. I think that's a big thing, is that I actually kind of had, prior to getting so into this Olympic image that I, you know, had created, was that I always said Christina Smith before I would say the Olympian.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was something I drove home. So when I did transition, I even would remove my Olympic ring just so that I would try to make it easier for myself. And but of course, you still get those depressive moments. You still get, you know, to the point that anyone that is going through depression will understand about not being able to get out of bed. And the big things are, we have to, you know, create a new identity for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We have to create a support group for ourselves. We have to create a schedule for ourselves, something that makes us stick to a routine, whether it be booking appointments with people, but something that gets us out of bed. Because, you know, whether I was strong as an athlete, boy, I tell you, those moments where I was as weak as
a kitten.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. It is always tough to transition out of your career. But today we have athletes that are transitioning into a career or taking their career further. This week we're talking about volleyball. We're going to get all the sports in before the Olympics in London. And it's amazing we're starting now, because they're still more than a year away. But our next two guests, Lauren O'Reilly, is a setter for the Langley, BC team, and played the past two seasons at Trinity Western University, falling 1 year at NCAA. And she was a starting setter for the second year for the Canadian team. She's going to be on the show coming up here in a second. And along with her, Dallas Sunias, I think I spelled his name right, from Red Deer. And he's a right-side player in the Canadian senior team for the past seven seasons. So he has a lot of experience. Welcome to the show, you two.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, Dallas. Nice to have you. Lauren, are you there?
Thanks for having me.
Lauren, are you there?
Can you hear me?
There we are. There we are. We found you. Hey, great. Welcome both of you to our show. Tell us both. We'll start with you, Lauren. How did you get into volleyball?
I was just one of those kids that loved the gym. I played like baseball, soccer, basketball, and my school offered soccer, basketball, and volleyball. So I just played all three. And yeah, I actually liked basketball more when I was younger. So,
how about you, Dallas?
Well, you know, I pretty much played everything as a kid, but me and my brother, we played basketball, and then volleyball season was before basketball season. So I tried it to stay in shape for basketball, and it was awesome, so I just stuck with it.
Wow.
Hmm. Now, I read, Lauren, that you have innate sight as a setter. Now, how do you develop that ability?
Yeah, I was learning that. I've been told that, and I think it's something that you're born with in a way. I think playing a lot of sports helped me develop it further. A big part of a setter is their mind and how they can kind of deceive the other blockers. And yeah, I think it's just being able to see the court well. Is, you know, you kind of like the QB out there, right? Like the quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know. I just find it easier, like, just to see. I don't know. I don't really know how, really, but I think the multitude of sports, the multitude of games that I've been playing, like, I think that just helped me develop that.
I watch a lot of sports. Like, I literally PVR everything. I'm so fanatical about this. I have two PVRs in my house, and they're always right at 98%. I mean, they're full. So anytime sports comes on, I'm watching it. And I love watching volleyball. But one of the things, Dallas, that hit me is this, is that volleyball has this funny thing about it where if a team gets on a roll, the other team can't seem to get on the roll. It's almost like they see themselves as loser, or they can't get a point. What do you do to get the team to go in the other direction?
Well, you know, what we do is we train so hard. And a big part of that is mental training. And when you get in a bad position like that, you pretty much have to go back to your training and trust it, and trust that you've done all this hard work to prepare for when you get into these bad positions. So you just you've been there before in your training, so you know how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Lauren.
Yeah.
Oh, Now, Lauren, you came home to go to Trinity Western from Michigan State because you were something I actually don't get, and that's homesick. Now, how is the transition to Winnipeg?
It's different. Like, I'm in Winnipeg because I'm pursuing an Olympic dream, right? That wasn't really happening at Michigan State in the same sense. Both times, yeah, I have to leave my family, and I'm pretty close with my family. But coming to Winnipeg, like, I'm coming here to train to aspire to be in the Olympics, right? So it's a lot different. It's easy to come to train, even though it's hard work. Like, it's easier to come to train knowing that I have that mental picture in my head of being at the Olympics one day.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I have my boyfriend's in Winnipeg, so that makes it a little easier.
Oh, well, there. That makes it make sense now. Now we understand. How about you, Dallas? You had to go from Red Deer to Quebec City. What's that like?
Yeah, I didn't do that.
Oh, you didn't?
I went to Gatineau.
Okay.
But, yeah, it you know, it wasn't really too hard, because by the time we went to Gatineau, it... I'd already played college ball away from home, and then I'd already played professional volleyball in Europe. So the transition to Gatineau wasn't that hard at all.
Mm-hmm.
As a volleyball player, you play professionally in the winter, and then with the national team in the summer, so you're kind of always changing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of just part of the game.
Is it a great site?
Oh, it's great. Yeah.
The training center?
That they built for us, It's a lot easier on the body than where we were training.
Yeah.
And we have priority over everything, so yeah. It's really great for us.
Lauren, how about the one in Winnipeg?
The center?
Yeah. Is it nice?
Yeah, it's nice. It's all right. It's okay. It's not, like, top of the line. It's Winnipeg, right? It's I'm from Vancouver, right? Like, so
boy,
it's
I bet
not
you're,
really a comparison to the city type, but...
I bet you're glad they can't hear this in Winnipeg.
Yeah. It's freezing. There's snow on the ground still. It's, like, sunny, and it's, like, summer in Langley.
You're listening to the Jungle Jim Hunter Show on Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 960, fan960.com. We're talking to Lauren O'Reilly, who is one of the athletes trying to make the Olympic team to go to London, and Dallas Sunius, who is one of the athletes on the male side, trying to make the team.
Now, Lauren.
Hey, Lauren.
Yeah.
Lauren, can you hear me, Lauren?
Yeah, I can.
Are you in Langley right now?
No, I'm actually in. No, I'm in Winnipeg. I'm in Winkler, actually coaching that volleyball tournament.
Okay.
I think you guys have to go for coffee or something.
You guys just carry on. We'll just. You guys carry on. We'll just go and get a coffee.
Wait, by the way, I wanted to mention something that you were talking about earlier there, Jim. You know, who was it? Bruce Lee was talking about being water, and you know how water water takes any form. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Like gas seems like it would be hard to control. So Bruce Lee, he was pretty good at what he did, so maybe be water.
Okay.
Nice.
I'm not saying that it all has to be my way. I'm just suggesting, that's all.
Well, I just thought, you know, put my 2 cents in.
Hey, that's why we do this show.
For sure. And Dallas, doesn't he sound like a radio announcer?
He does.
You should be in radio, Dallas.
You should be in radio, Dallas.
Well, you know, I got the face for it.
I'm envious. I wish I had your voice.
Now, Lauren, how important is your family to your development, and what key roles have they played?
Yeah, my family's huge. My family's awesome. I was born into a great family. Everyone's pretty athletic. And so I grew up with, I have four other siblings. There's five kids. And I grew up with an older brother who's super athletic. And so I always played, like, road hockey with him, and, like, basketball, and, like, beach volleyball in the backyard. So, like, always competing with an older brother who's, like, better, faster, stronger than you are. Like, I can't help but get better, I think. So I think having an older brother, like, always playing sports with me, like, just made me, like, way more athletic, and really helped. Obviously, it helped also my parents, like, just being at every single game. They're pretty pretty loyal fans.
I wanted to ask you, Dallas, because I'm curious to know, what's the hardest training that they make you do at the center?
Oh, that's a good question. To be honest, we train our bodies so hard that the physical aspect isn't the hardest part, it's the mental part, you know, to keep going every day. Because really, you know, we're in the gym every day, and if we were doing drills to punish or, like, beat an athlete down, it would be useless, you know? Because we only have so many jumps in our legs every day.
Yeah.
I'd say the things that are difficult are the mental aspect of it.
Mm.
Why is it tough mentally? Tell me why it's tough mentally.
Well, you know, like you would know, you've done the training for your sport. You train every day.
Yep.
And you're in the gym 5-6 hours a day, and sometimes it's hard to keep going. And you break the game down to the smallest components, and when you can't get something right, it can be so frustrating because you got five other guys on the court, and you have a team of 12 plus the coaches, and if you're letting people down, it's hard to keep going. You know, it's a real team sport like that.
Yeah. Wow.
Now, Lauren, do you have a favorite sports story that inspires you and keeps you going? And then we'll also ask you, Dallas, that.
I was thinking about that. I don't really. Honestly, what keeps me training, like the 5-7 hours a day that we do, like it's like that mental picture of like me being at the Olympics. That's what keeps me going day in and day out. It can get so mundane trying to slowly get better, like hour after hour. Like I think just the thought of being at the Olympics one day, like that's what keeps me going day in and day out.
How about you, Dallas?
Well, you know, I've been lucky. I've had great coaching pretty much the whole way through, and I've played for a lot of Olympians.
Uh-huh.
So reaching what they've done would be great. Just hearing the stories that they have, you know, it's super inspiring. These things used to really motivate me, and they still do. But it seems the older I get, I'm more motivated by my family and representing my people. I'm an Indian, and there aren't a ton of Indian elite athletes out there.
No.
So I really have to be a role model in everything I do. And one thing we teach is to try to honor your ancestors every day. That's a really hard thing to do, but it's something I've been doing for the last little while. That's what inspires me.
So are you an Aboriginal, a purebred, if I can say that? I did say it. Aboriginal Canadian?
What's your nation?
Oh, my dad's Cree. He's from Saskatchewan, and my mom's Ojibwe from Ontario. So I'm a mix of whatever that is. I'm a mutt.
Well, wow. Congratulations!
That's awesome.
I didn't know that. Thank
what
you so much for letting us know that.
You go.
You can be a tremendous inspiration to the native Canadian kids because if you guys get to the Olympics, that'll be fabulous.
Well, you know, I do what I can. I try to do like weekend camps and stuff in remote communities and whatever, because you know, you got to give back. You get to a certain point, you got to give back.
Absolutely.
Good for you. Wow.
Hey, thanks, Dallas. Thanks, Lauren. We really appreciate it. All the best. Hope you guys get all the way through. I know you've got an enormous qualification to go through to get there, but thank you for doing so much work and representing our country.
Hey, thanks
a lot, hey?
Thank
Come
you
back anytime.
See you, Dallas.
All right. They'll just carry on, have their own little conversation.
That
we'll
was
just,
cute.
We'll just go for coffee. That was great. Hey, transition. These guys are going through transition. We're going to learn from John Blatcher, who's going to tell us what they have to go through to get there. Because a lot of people think we're supposed to win all the time, right? These teams have to go up against so many tough teams. I didn't know this until I talked to him in setting up this show. There's only 11 teams go to the Olympic Games from all over the world. You're going to be one of the best 11 in the world to get to the Olympic Games. So they have a big road ahead of them.
Wow.
We'll be right back. You're listening to the Jungle Jim Hunter Show on Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 960, and fan960.com.
This is the Jungle Jim Hunter Show, only on the Fan 960, Calgary's only all sports radio.
Albert Camus said this: man is the only creature that refuses to be what he is. I love the fact that Dallas interacted, Christina, with us on that. What do you want to be? Gas, solid, or liquid? The point being, I'm trying to get you to think, which is what I was trying to do, and so it worked. What do you want to be? Because sometimes you want to be solid. When you're performing, you want to be all three. You want your imagination to go where you want to go. You want to be liquid so you can flow. And you want to be solid and strong so that you're doing and performing what you're doing to the best of your ability. The point is, be used to transitioning and changing. And learning how to do that. That's the whole point. I love the fact that he interacted. That is so cool. And we are going to do what you suggested. I want to do what you suggested.
Really?
Let's have a show that is just all Native Canadians.
Excellent.
Let's do that.
That's awesome.
I've never thought of that until he said what he said. And then when we got off the air, we went, let's do that.
Yeah. I think that'd be really motivational.
Alwyn Morris? Isn't he Native Canadian? I think Alwyn Morris is. I could be wrong. I could be out of wind. Anyway, it's time for the PT Advantage Health Hint. We're talking to Jonathan Reimer this week. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
He's in athletic therapy as a degree. Man, this guy's got a list. I'm not even going to list these. There's so many of them, Jonathan. Wow.
Yeah, a lot of years of training.
Wow. People talk about core strength. Let's get a clear picture of what it means to strengthen our core from every vantage.
Well, yeah, most people that talk about core strength in your popular exercise programs nowadays are talking about general abdominal and low back strengthening. The thing is that these muscles are designed to move us and not to specifically stabilize us. So if we try to recruit them to create stability in our spine, what ends up happening is we get harmful compressive and shear forces, as opposed to being able to use them for their proper function, which is to move us for athletic participation and other activities.
Now, anyone that does a sit-up, you know, they're thinking that they're doing this core strength. However, can you tell them how wrong it is that it's not just the sit-up that makes you feel that way or that it attains what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the research defines the true core. It's our deepest layer of abdominal and low back muscles. They include the transverse abdominis, the multifidus, the pelvic floor, and the diaphragm. So most regular type of sit-up exercises, they don't specifically target these muscles. And if you're not functioning properly or if those muscles aren't firing properly, those typical types of programs can actually have harmful effects instead of beneficial.
How can you know if you have someone that is teaching you the right way to do core training? Because I've seen what you've just talked about. I've seen people that, you know, they look in a book, they take out a list of exercises, and they say, do this, do this, do this. And I look at it and I go, man, from a core strength for training program, if I just listen and you're training for this sport or that sport, you're doing the wrong exercises. You're not even doing the right ones. And you're going to go through this whole workout and you're not going in the right direction. How can you know, or what are some of the clues that you can use to identify people that know what they're doing when it comes to core training?
Yeah, that's a great question. Honestly, it takes years of experience, in my opinion, to properly be able to palpate or feel those muscles in action and determine whether or not they're firing. And then the other thing that we do as therapists, and probably some well-trained personal trainers have these abilities as well, you look for compensatory movements that suggest that the core is not working, that you're relying on your outer abdominal muscles. And I don't want to imply that abdominal strength or back strength is a bad thing. It's just that those muscles have a specific purpose, and if we're not using the inner core to create a brace for us, then we're going to actually end up not maximizing our functional capabilities.
So essentially, if you're overweight, you have very little core strength. So that push, like, would that put any type of stress on the lower back then?
Yeah, I mean, definitely being overweight can put a lot of load on our back that can create problems. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have good core function. I've seen elite level athletes with really poor core function. And basically what you're losing is that internal bracing system that creates stability or powerful movements. So I would say it's typically those individuals that have had a back injury or people that have complained about having a bad back for years. Those are the ones that should definitely get checked out, because pain can inhibit the function of the core, and you can work really hard to try to get it firing, but unless you know the proper steps to take and the proper exercises to do, you're likely going to just end up doing a general abdominal strengthening program, which can actually, as I said, have more problematic effects for you.
Absolutely. Hey, Jonathan, thanks so much. How do people get a hold of you if they want to find you?
Well, we're over at Advantage Health Aspen in the Southwest. Okay. But we do have a number of other Advantage Health clinics in the city. Our number is 403-242-9900. 9001. Sorry, I had a little brain.
It's morning. That's morning. That's all right.
And PT Health offers free consultation and a $20 off any of the services for new clients. So, but they have to say that
they heard it on here.
On the Jungle Jim Hunter Show.
Thanks, Jonathan.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
We said we were going to get every sport on between now and the London Olympics. And we have to start now because if we get every sport on that's competed and also the Paralympic sports that are on this program, we're going to have to start now because we're going to have one every weekend. And this weekend we're focusing on Volleyball Canada and our volleyball teams. And next we're going to talk to John Blatcher, who's the National Team Director of Operations from Winnipeg. And he's trying to come up with a name for the Winnipeg Jets. If they can't call him the Jets, he's got to call him something. John, welcome to the program. What are you going to call the new team?
Well, I think my my sentimental favorite is the Falcons.
Okay.
The 1920 Olympic team. The first, I know it was a demonstration during those games, but I think that was the first gold medal for hockey, and that was the Winnipeg team.
Wow. We're talking about volleyball. We've had on your high-performance director and two of your athletes, Lauren and Dallas, and it was great to talk to them. Tell our listeners how many different teams we have in Volleyball Canada, and both indoor and beach, because you're responsible for both, right?
I'm actually just indoor, but Volleyball Canada obviously looks after both disciplines, as well as the sitting discipline, which is our Paralympic sport.
Wow. Canadians want us to win medals, but in your sport, just like getting to the games is phenomenally accomplishment because it's so hard. Tell our listeners the arduous process we have to go through to get to the games, because I don't think Canadians realize how tough it is, and the fact that I think you told me there's only 11 teams make it to the Olympics?
Well, really there is, because it is a 12-team tournament, but one always goes to the host country of the Olympics, so you're really fighting for only 11 spots. The thing about volleyball, as is, many other team sports, summer team sports especially, is that the depth of the playing field around the world is deep. There's many, many strong nations that play the sport seriously, that play the sport at a very high level. It's a very popular sport, not only participation-wise, but professionally around the world. Zones such as Europe, you have probably 12, 16 countries there that are very strong. Asia, South America, it's really deep around the world. And when you only fight for 11 spots, it's incredibly difficult. We fight mainly out of our zone to get a berth to the Olympics, and our zone includes North America, Central America, and the Caribbean. It's called NORCICA.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we're competing against world powers such as USA. Men's Olympic champions from 08, Cuba, perennial powerhouse, other strong nations that are emerging now, such as Puerto Rico and Mexico. And with the women especially, there's another country in that mix in the Dominican Republic who's really, really done good things to their national team program down there and are excelling on the international stage as well. So you have that opportunity. There's one chance, one berth out of our zone, and then if you're lucky, you may get a last chance qualification opportunity where you're going to be competing against some of the other top European, South American, or Asian teams that haven't qualified at that last opportunity in May 2012 as well. So it's a tough go. It's a tough. Our men's indoor national team was last in the Olympics in 92 Barcelona, and our women 96 Atlanta, and we're due. 2012, I hope we're due.
We are due. And now, John, what is the best we've ever done?
Best we've ever done was probably 84 Olympics. We had an incredible group of men's athletes. They finished fourth. They just lost in the bronze medal match. I think it was to Italy. But that group was still one of the best ever we had. We put together, although it was the Eastern Bloc Olympics, it was still probably even with the Eastern Bloc teams, that was a medal contending team. Mm-hmm. That was on the indoor side. On the beach side, however, we've had some success. 96 Olympics, our team of the first ever Olympics with beach volleyball, our team of John Child and Mark Hees, bronze medalists in beach volleyball. So we've had success on the beach in recent years, although we didn't qualify for beach or indoor in 08 Beijing.
I'm curious to know, because when you think of volleyball, you think most people just play it in school. How many clubs and how many members, how many people across Canada play volleyball in any kind of competitive ratio? I was just curious to know how many there is.
Well, those who play volleyball versus those who play competitively is completely different. There's probably a million people who play somewhat regularly the sport. However, our membership is probably around 30,000 members, which is probably anywhere between 2,500 and 3,000 teams across the country.
Wow.
That includes teams from your 12 and under to all the way to senior, like myself, who still plays once a week in the men's league in Winnipeg here. So there's quite a bit of numbers. So to participate at our national championship, we have over 800 teams that compete every spring, every May at our national championships. And actually, next year, 2012, is going to be one massive one in one city under, not necessarily one roof entirely, but mostly under one roof in Toronto. It's going to, our goal there is 1,000 teams competing at our national championships at the various levels next May.
Where are they this spring?
This spring, they're all over the country.
Okay.
Calgary usually hosts a big event in the 15-under, 16-under. I believe Saskatoon is the 14-and-under. If I'm not mistaken, BC is also the 17- and 18-and-under category. So they're spread out around the country right now.
Hmm.
Beautiful.
Now, does Volleyball Canada have any funding issues? Or have you been supported by Own the Podium or other sponsors?
We have various levels of sponsor support, but when you compare our budgets, when you compare our support to the top nations in the world, we're way off. However, although not initially targeted as a summer OTP sport, we have recently been targeted with our men's indoor program for it's a team OTP initiative that was unrolled recently, and our men's team was the recipient of some funding with that. It's going to help, definitely. You know, we have some support there to try and address our systemic weaknesses in our athlete development model, and we're trying to look at ways that we can close that gap between us and the top nations in the world as best possible and as quickly as possible. However, our women's team weren't as lucky in terms of accessing that funding and beach programs as well. Our sitting programs have received a little bit that will hopefully help them qualify for the 2012 Paralympics in London as well. So yes, we're always short. We're always shy. We're very aggressive in fundraising initiatives and revenue generation strategies to try and help our teams with training and competition costs they desperately need.
Yeah. I'm curious to know if you have any kind of a ratio factor. I remember talking to Cycling Canada, had their high-performance coach on about a year ago or 2 years ago, and I said, you know, what's the difference between here and there? And he was from Britain, and he says the difference is Britain spends $50 for every $1 we spend in Canada on our cycling team. I wonder what the ratio is in volleyball.
I would probably say that it might be, if I just compare to our southern partner in the U.S., we're probably about 25% of what their budget is. It's
wow.
Probably about a 4-to-1
ratio.
Difference.
Yeah.
You know, you also have to take that into context with your national situation. For example, Cuba likely is not as much as Canada, but their socio-cultural differences in that nation, help them achieve where we, you know, our athletes aren't. Make a national team and to be successful, that's a big deal in Cuba.
Yeah.
To make a national team and to be successful, you're actually probably financially hindering yourself in our nation comparative to what you might be able to do in the professional world type of thing.
So absolutely.
You have to take those type of things into context. But yeah, against the top nations in the world, Brazil would probably be, I'd say, at least an 8 or a 10-to-1 difference in their national team budget. So it's there's a gap there.
Yeah. John, before I let you go, I just want to know what keeps you going? What motivates you?
What motivates me is seeing the team succeed on the floor. And then I'm involved in most of the competitions on a domestic level here for the national teams. When we do host a world qualifier or an Olympic qualifier, you know, I was on the court side when our women qualified for 96 at the qualifier in Winnipeg. And when our men qualified for the 2002 World Championships again in Winnipeg, and seeing the excitement, the electricity, how happy they are when they achieve those goals, and the fans that come out and cheer them on and are ecstatic when we get those results. That's what motivates me, and that's what inspires me, is to try and get those athletes to where they want to be.
Thanks, John. We appreciate you coming on. By the way, I have a name for your team. You should call them the Winnipeg Mosquitoes.
Yeah. That was brought up, too. That's not
going to
happen.
Okay. Thanks so much. It's John Blatcher. He's responsible for our high-performance team director, national team director of operations for our training center in Winnipeg. When we come back, we'll wrap it up. We'll talk about transitioning and a couple of other things. We'll be right back. You're listening to Jungle Jim Hunter on the Jungle Jim Hunter Show on Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 960, and thefan960.com. Winston Churchill said this: to improve is to change. To be perfect is to change often. Talking about transitioning this week, how to change, what to do in transition. I don't want you to forget, you can listen to the Detroit Phoenix game right after the show on the Fan 960, so we'll get out of here as quick as we can. Christine and I will wrap it up. But first of all, we got to do the fitness focus moment with Andrew McGregor. Andrew McGregor is our spokesman from Specialized Bike. Andrew, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Jim. Hi, Christina.
Good morning.
What's the biggest mistake parents make in purchasing a bike for their child this spring?
Excellent question. Biggest thing people do is they unfortunately buy, they go for the lowest price thing they can see. Not always the best thing when dealing with kids. Kids, as you know, I've got two young ones myself. They break everything. So spending a little bit more up front, making sure you go and have it built professionally by a bike store, will actually, the bike will last longer, they'll have more fun with it, you'll have less problems, and you'll actually be able to sell it for more money and or reuse it with a younger sibling.
Now, what would be the questions that I would ask if I was going out and buying a bike for myself?
You know what? At the end of the day, I think it's you should listen more, and it's what the consultant or the person you're helping you buy the bike is asking you. At the end of the day, they have to know what experience you want to have on your bike. That way they can decide, or help you decide, should I say, on which model of bike you should get.
Is there a prescribed method cyclists can follow to get most out of the conditioning component of a bike? Because I think a lot of people have good intentions, and I sometimes put bikes, and maybe I'm wrong to look at this way, but, you know, people buy treadmills, they collect dust and become coat hangers, right? People buy bicycles, and they become rust buckets in the backyard because they don't really figure out how to use it effectively. They start out with good intentions, but then they don't do it. Is there some place, or do you provide a program where people can follow a cycling program?
Not really. What I suggest, and this is more to myself, I mean, at the end of the day, talking to a trainer or somebody who deals with getting people into shape is a great way to build a program for yourself, because everybody's different. For me, I find the best way for me is to get back into shape on my bike is just going out there, doing some nice relaxing miles, enjoy the scenery, enjoy, you know, going for a ride. That's the big thing. And then once you get that going, you can start adding intensity. You can start adding, you know, different terrain, like climbing. Like today, I want to go up the hill three times or whatever. So making your own goals and setting them for yourself and following through is the best way to do it. But at the end of the day, the only way you keep riding your bike is just to enjoy riding your bike.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't stress enough, people still cringe about getting back on that little bike seat. And, I mean, that is the big thing for me. I don't care what the bike looks like, how it can perform. It's really that bike seat. And I just wanted you to kind of touch on that with that bike fitting system.
Okay. I thought of a couple of things since we chatted last week. All of our specialized dealers, at least a big chunk of them, do have a program where we have test saddles. So people can try different saddles before they decide which one to buy to make sure they get the most comfortable one they can. Add to that, using our saddle measuring tool to make sure the saddle will support you properly so you're not getting pressure in places you don't want to have it. Those two things together, along with a little bit of just, you know, people's input, trying the bike, seeing what it's like, will definitely be able to help mitigate some of it. And also, I can't stress enough, I forgot this one last week, cycling shorts.
Yes.
Beans are not an option.
That's so true.
No kidding. Well, listen, if people want more information, where can they find out more?
Best place to go is specialized.com. We actually have a bike finder part of the website where you can click on, you answer a couple of questions, and it'll give you an idea as to what bike you want to get.
Mm-hmm. He's Andrew McGregor. He's their spokesman. I love that.
Spokesman?
I love that. You know, I don't care. I just think it's funny. Anyway, thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Jim.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye. Well, our final guest today, and we've had an action-packed show. We're not even going to get to talk here, but I wanted to have this guy on because I started reading this new book this week, Patriot Hearts. John Furlong,
nice
guy that did the Olympics in Vancouver, and I started reading it, and I wanted to have him on. Gary Mason co-wrote it. I don't know if he co-wrote it, or it just says with Gary Mason, so he must have co-wrote it with him. He's our national affairs columnist for the Globe and Mail, based in Vancouver. He previously spent 19 years at the Vancouver Sun in various capacities, including 7-year stint as a popular sports columnist, and he's received the prestigious Jack Webster Award for journalism 6 times, and has won 2 national newspaper awards. Patriot Hearts is his 6th book. And next week, we're going to go more in-depth in the book, but I wanted to have him on. Gary, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be on the program, Jim.
We appreciate the fact that this morning you were supposed to play hockey, then you didn't get picked up, and now you're here, and you're available, and we're so glad that that worked out, because we didn't think we were going to have you. You and John wrote the book, a wonderful book, Patriot Hearts. I've started reading it. What enduring thoughts come to your mind when you think of the Olympic Games, separate from the book? What is your memory as a Vancouverite?
Well, I guess I have 2 sort of overwhelming memories. One is I was lucky enough to be at the gold medal hockey game, probably 15 rows away from where Sidney Crosby scored the goal, the golden goal that is probably one of the most historic goals in Canadian hockey history, for sure.
Everybody so, I meet tells me that.
Yeah.
They all say they were 8 rows up.
Yeah, well, I was, actually. I was sort of on the other side of the ice, but that doesn't matter. But so, I mean, just being in the building was just was a real thrill, obviously. But, you know, as I tell everybody, Jim, I think the best venue at the Olympics was on the streets of Vancouver. It was just absolutely amazing, and we'll never probably see that again unless the Vancouver Canucks win the Stanley Cup, and there's a chance that could happen. But it was just amazing, you know, like just tens of thousands of people sort of streaming down the streets and just sort of all deliriously happy, and there was sort of never ever a threat that it was going to get out of control or, you know, something bad was going to happen, because those streets have been known to have bad things happen on them before. So that was definitely my favorite memory, was just walking the streets with the people, with the fellow Canadians.
Nice. I did that stretch. That was crazy. Now it's a year later, and have you noticed a change in the people in Vancouver as a result of these Olympics?
I'm not, you know, that's a real, a lot of people ask that question, you know, has the city changed? It's just a difficult question to answer, because I don't know, you know, there's just sort of no empirical evidence that you have that would, you know, support your thesis that it has changed the people. I think the city is definitely, you know, perhaps more competent, I think more than anything, though, it's absolutely wonderful memory for the city and for the people that live here and were able to experience it. I don't think it really needs to be anything more than that. But I just think it's really impossible to say whether it's changed the city or not.
What is the lasting memory that you talk about or that comes back to you again and again out of the book? Because obviously the book gave you a lot of reflection with John Furlong, and it gave you a chance to really kind of go in depth. What is the enduring thing out of the book that people will remember?
Well, I think the book is really a whole bunch of things, really. I mean, it's a behind-the-scenes look at the games and how they were organized. I think for business people, the book is a great book on leadership and how you lead a big group of people through some very turbulent times. So I think for aspiring, you know, CEOs or business leaders, it's a fantastic book. I guess for me, that the most enduring thing is how John's vision of what he thought these games could be actually came true. Because, I mean, he kind of blueprinted this thing in 2002, wrote it out and said, you know, this is what I think these games can be. And all the way along, he pushed that vision. And a lot of people sneered at him and kind of rolled their eyes behind his back and said it was never going to happen. And it actually happened almost exactly the way he imagined it happening. So I think that is probably the biggest thing that I'm left with after talking to him and spending so much time with him and writing this book, is just how his vision absolutely came through in exactly precisely the way he imagined it would.
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't know this. We've never met, and this is the first time we've even spoken on the phone, so to speak. But I read a book a week, and this is my book for this week. And next week, we're going to go in depth, and I'm going to ask you some questions what I read from the book. And we look forward to having you back.
I look forward to it, too.
And by the way, I want you to know something.
Yeah.
Vancouver will win the Stanley Cup. Do you know how I know?
Oh, nice. Okay.
Do you know how I know?
I'll put that out on Twitter this afternoon.
Well, no, I can tell you how you know. If you check the record for every city that has hosted the Winter Games, some team in their community the next year has won a major championship.
Yeah.
Montreal Canadiens won in 1976 and 77 after the 76 Olympics. We won the Stanley Cup in 89 after the Olympics were here.
Yeah.
You guys will win.
Well, that would be wonderful. It'd be a great thing for the city. They've been waiting a long time for it.
I hope you do. I hope you do. I really do.
Okay.
And then it'll go to the Winnipeg Mosquitoes, which is my new that's my new name for the new Jets.
I like it. I like it.
Blood donors.
Anyway, it'll be the blood donor clinic hockey team of the world.
Exactly.
Sponsored by Red Cross.
Okay.
There we go. Thanks, Gary. We'll look forward to talking to you next week.
Okay, talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The book's called Patriot Hearts, folks, and Gary Mason will be with us, and we'll expand it. This is my book of reading this week. Just so you know, folks, it's a ton of pages. There are, Gary, why did you write so many pages? I don't know. It's 350 pages here, so I'm going to have to push myself hard to get that one done this week. Anyway, I will. We want to wrap the show up today. Got about a minute left, Christina. We ran out of time. I don't even get to do my notes today.
Wow.
Transitioning.
Yeah.
What's your final thought on transitioning?
I'd say rebrand yourself and also take care of yourself, your self-care. So it's important to reduce that stress because it eats away at the B12 mm-hmm. in our system and silence that voice in the head because that voice can make you do crazy things. And make sure you eat and you nourish your body.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people forget about that and they just go, they're not strong enough to deal with transition.
I want to leave you with an amazing thought, and just a reminder, the Detroit Phoenix game is coming on right after the show, so you can hear it right here on the Fan 960. I want to leave you with this. Jim Rohn said this, for things to change, you've got to change. I have a rule called the 82% rule. Why do I have this rule? Well, I've noticed something. There are four groups of people that always end up in the same spot. 82% of them do. Lottery winners, sudden inheritance, retirees, and retired professional athletes. Here's the thing that is true about 82% of the time. Lottery winners, 82% of them, 3 years after they win the lottery are broke. Sudden inheritance, 82% of them, if they didn't earn it, it was just given to them, they lose it all within 5 years. Retirees, they're either dead or unable to sustain life and have to be cared for within 3 to 5 years after they retire. Why? Because they don't have a plan for what they're going to do. And retired professional athletes, they end up divorced. 82% of them. I know, it's not a very exciting way to end the program today. But there will come a point where you will get disgusted and say, I've had it. I want to change. I've driven this model long enough. Then you will have to make a decision. Making it is emotional. It is called inner civil war. But it means that you have to change. Then you have to develop a desire and want it bad enough. You have to come to a place where the desire is so great that you welcome each human experience of it. Resolve is the last part. Resolve to say, I'll do it or die. You say, that's a little strict. That's a little restrictive. Promising yourself you will never give up. How long should a baby learn to walk? Once? Twice? No, until they do it. How long should you press on when you're transitioning? Until you do it. What's the trigger? Taking action. If you're living in a moment of disgust and you need to make a decision and you have the desire and you're going to make the resolve to change, it'll only happen if you take action. You've been listening to Christina Smith and Jungle Jim Hunter on The Jungle Jim Hunter Show, Sportsnet Radio, The Fan 960, fan960.com. You can follow me. Twitter account is junglejimhunter.com.
Start.go.
And Brad Slater, I don't know what yours is, but... Oh, what?
Fan 960 Slater.
Ah, Fan 960 Slater. Thanks for producing, Brad. Appreciate it. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the Jungle Jim Hunter Show.